Tonight, I'd like to introduce our speaker for the evening, Mr. Rich. Come on up here. Thank you for sharing.
Hello, everybody. My name is Rich, and I'm an alcoholic. And an addict, too. Give me a second. I'm picturing you all naked, so I won't be nervous. Oh man, you know, it's a privilege. It's an honor to be here. You know, it's my first time speaking at Pioneers. I've been coming here for about almost 9 years, and it's home kind of basically. You know what I mean? It's my home group is the Nooner Monday through Friday. So it started way back in 1962. I was born July 10th, and my mom. I was born in San Francisco. My mom was an airline attendant at the time, and it didn't work out with my biological father. He was out of the picture before I was 1 year old. But shortly after that, my father, my adopted father, the one I call Dad. He married my mom, and he legally adopted me, gave me his last name and everything, and then shortly after that we had my brother Phil. So our family's kind of small. We started off. There's just six of us in the beginning. It was mom, dad, me, and Phil, and grandma, and grandpa, who lived in Chula Vista since '69, and so that's kind of like. In the beginning years, we lived in Guam for a minute. My dad was in the Navy, and so he was stationed on Guam, and we lived there for a little bit. And then by the time I was five, we moved to Paradise Hills, and I went to Robert E. Lee Elementary. It's called something else now, but I can't even pronounce it. There's so many words to the title. I mean, but anyways. You know, one of those, you know, explorer, world leader, whatever. It's an elementary school. Come on. Are you kidding me? You know. So that was kindergarten, first, second, and third. My childhood was pretty normal. Mom and dad were normies. They drank occasionally when they, you know, get-togethers and stuff like that. Dad was on a lot of Westpacs. He went on a lot of cruises. You know, he's gone for, you know, 8-9 months at a time. But those years were pretty good. We upgraded and we moved from Paradise Hills to all these track homes at the end of Palm Avenue on Otay Mesa. They were built in 1969-70, not too, kind of like around the time the Coronado Bridge was built. So we upgraded. We moved up there and to a cul-de-sac called Shepherd Lane. It's right off of Palm Avenue, and I live four doors down from Dougie's cousins. It's pretty wild. His cousin Ernie, Albert, and Josie, and their parents, and really nice people. Really nice people. And their house had a pool, so it was like really cool to go over there, you know. As a matter of fact, Dougie's cousin Josie was my first kiss. And it was Ernie's idea, her brother. We were playing Truth or Dare. So, I remember that. That was the first girl I ever kissed. I think I was like 11 years old or something like that. We go back a little ways. I mean, and then later on, you know, Ernie, Dougie's cousin, they got dirt bikes and stuff, and I think I met you once or twice, maybe, right around the time I was leaving that area, but it was pretty wild. Everything was pretty normal, you know, like kindergarten through sixth grade. I was kind of like a nerd, you know. I built models and stuff like that. I felt like a normie. I didn't feel like any different than anybody else, it was fun. We had a lot of fun. BMX, skateboards, all that stuff. Our generation invented BMX, you know. We used to get the Schwinn's and chop them up and all that stuff and raise the frames and the diamond cranks and the Ashtabula forks and all that stuff. But it was, you know, it was when kids used to play outside. You remember that?
Yeah.
Some of you in that, you know, remember that, you know. Instead of having a video game stuck in their face, you know. But then 7th grade started, and then that's when it got different. So the first drink I remember was me and my little brother were sipping off some cold duck and I think some Oli at one of my parents' get-togethers. They had a couple of couples over, but that was when I was pretty young. That was still like when I was in 4th grade. But I don't really consider that my first drink. My first drink was kind of like when I was like 12, and me and like 5 other guys were hanging out in Rick's backyard, and one day we got bored, and Mike goes, "Hey man, my dad's got an alcohol, a liquor cabinet," and my other homie Paul goes, "Go get it, man," and so he comes back with a bottle of tequila, and Rick goes in with comes out with like some lemon and some salt, and he goes, "Yeah, this is the way you're supposed to do it." You know, we're like 12 years old. You know what I mean? And you got to put the salt on your hand, you know, and the lemon. And so we're passing this tequila bottle around with the shot glass, and it was strong, man. It was like, I think it was Jose Cuervo, and it was like, that was my first drink. So. That kind of like sort of, you know, got my feet wet, and then 7th grade started, and then that's when it all kind of started right then, man. 13 years old, okay. First day of school, we're on the way to school, smoking weed, drinking beer, you know, going to Montgomery Middle School, junior high. They call it middle school now, but it was junior high back then. And then it was like, and it was almost daily from the start, you know, and what happened was it was everything was pretty cool. But then the following year, when I went to 8th grade, I ditched a lot of school. I missed like 75 school days, so I failed 8th grade. And so then the sign of the unmanageability, right? It's already starting to kick in, right? 13 years old, 14 years old. So, but we didn't call it that back then. But anyways, so I. That was the end of my time at Shepherd Lane, and we moved down to Main Street by Melrose, and they built some townhomes down there by the 805 freeway and Main Street. And so I repeated 8th grade at Castle Park, and it continued, you know, just smoking weed every day and drinking and all that stuff. And, but I did okay at Castle Park. I got through that with a little continuation, and then after that, I moved to LA. Okay, my parents had divorced when I was 10 years old, and so that was a pretty traumatic experience. It turned my whole world upside down. Actually, I couldn't understand it. I couldn't wrap my head around it. And I was 10, and my brother was 8, and that started like that trade off deal where you get like. You know, you go with mom this time and I go with dad, and, you know, kind of like, you know, and that kind of thing started happening. And so we moved down to Main Street, and that summer, it was the summer of 76. Oh, God, we partied, man. We had a tree fort down in the swamp. We built a tree fort. We call it the Cloud, right? And in order to get up there, there was no ladder. You had to learn how to climb the tree. Okay, but when you're 15, you're a monkey. You can climb anything, right? So there's like 8 of us up there. You know, we're drinking and doing bongs and just, you know, the whole summer, man. It was just there was literally a cloud coming out of that place, and then after that, that's when my time in San Diego ended, and I moved to L.A. Okay, and then I did 9th grade in L.A. I went to I did two junior highs here and 2 junior highs in L.A. So the first one was in the city of Harbor City, and I got kicked out for weed possession, right? So out by the baseball diamond, and there's like three of us out there, and we're smoking weed, and then we're on our way back, right? Because the bell rang. And these two narcs approached us, right? And So I kind of like, I had a little thing in my pocket and I kind of dropped it out on the ground and they saw it. They picked it up and they called the sheriff, right? So there's this female LA County sheriff in the dean's office and I go in there and she goes, look, we're not going to arrest you for one joint. She goes, but you are going to have to find another school to go to. I think they're going to expel you from this one. I go, okay. That school kind of sucked anyway. So I was kind of cool. That worked out, though. It worked out really good. I ended up going to a better school, and I finished ninth grade there. What was cool about that school was I had this gym coach, man, and he just ran us all the time. And we ran the mile all the time, man. And my best mile time was like 6:09, which wasn't bad for a cigarette smoker and a stoner. But we ran a lot, you know. I did all right there, and I remember I had this arts and crafts class, and it's kind of like in the ceramics, I built this like ceramic toilet, man, and the art teacher was like, he was like, oh my God, bro, he goes, that's the best project I ever seen, dude. He goes, I hope it doesn't blow up in the kiln, right? It was like an ashtray, but it was a toilet, and he put it in the kiln, we fired it, and he goes, it came out great, man. So I had that for a while, and that was just like, you know, I don't even seen that movie Dazed and Confused, you know, where they're in the class and he's showing them like the bong. It's got a leak in it. There's your problem right there, bro. You got a leak. You put some gum on it, you know. It was kind of like that, you know. It's like, you know, like my school days, like I struggled, you know, like with math. You know, I wasn't very good at math, and the important classes like math, English, and stuff like that, I would get like a C or a D. And then like A+ in metal shop, PE, you know, and I was good at history. I liked history. So the grades would kind of offset each other a little bit, you know what I mean? And so I made it, you know, and then after that, I only lived in LA that 1 year. That was, I finished that like in the summer of 78. And then my mom took us, she knew me and my brother were struggling here in California. We were kind of messing up. And so she moved back to Massachusetts, and at the town of Danvers, which is about 45 minutes north of Boston, and that's where I graduated high school. I went to 10th, 11th, and 12th there, and it just, you know, that place was cool, man. But anyways, I got there the summer of 78, you know, and I walked up with long hair. These guys all got crew cuts and stuff. They're like, who's this Bunsen, you know what I mean? That's what they used to call him back there. You were a Bunsen burnout, you know what I mean? And so shortly after that, I kind of felt out of place. I got my hair cut, you know, I kind of tried to fit in, you know, a little bit. And then I grew it back later on because I joined a band, right? So that's when I started playing guitar. And the kids back east were awesome. They were really cool. And those guys could drink, man. Let me tell you, they weren't no joke. I was nothing but a lightweight punk back there. Those guys could drink. I mean, it seemed like my friends were like full-blown alcoholics at 16 almost. I mean, that's how much they drank, right? And so, like, I really had nothing to compare it to. You know what I mean? Like, it's just everything looked like alcoholism the way we partied. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, like, who wasn't? You know what I mean? It was like... And so it was like, it kind of went like that all the way through high school. And I ended up graduating. And those years back there were really cool. You know, I can remember in the summertime going to this one keg party. It was like 13 kegs. The whole high school was there. Four live bands. It was like, you know, those kind of parties, you know, like, you know, when it was a free country. Remember, like, you know, back in the 70s, you know, like in the early 80s and stuff, you know. And you could do that, you know. We had a really good time. Those years, like, I was controlling and enjoying it, right? So it was going really well, I thought. And then, so I graduated high school in June of 81, and then I moved back to California, and I went to L.A. So I lived in L.A. from 81 to 2009. And so when I first got back to L.A., you know, I started playing music with my stepbrother and my friend Terry, and we started this little band, and we were playing, like, mostly AC/DC. We're really into AC/DC. We're like, that's all we did almost, you know what I mean? And so the other day when we're trying to jam one of the tunes, I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember that song. Yeah. So, Because they're like, we're looking for new songs to play. And it's like, oh, yeah, I remember all these AC/DC songs in there. So it just kind of like kind of went that way. I also got a job in the printing industry as soon as I graduated high school. I had a year class of print shop when I was in high school as a senior. And so when I got back, I was looking for a job. And I saw this press trainee job. And that ended up being a 27-year career. So we used to run the big presses, the magazine presses, the catalogs, coupons. I used to work for the world's biggest commercial printer, R.R. Donnelly, in L.A. in Torrance. And it was great. And that was probably one of the best opportunities I ever had in my life. And so that went pretty good. So this was around 81 when I got the job in August of 81, and I was like 19 years old. And I continued, you know, drinking and smoking weed, and still controlling and enjoying. I didn't feel like I was alcoholic yet because I could start and stop whenever I wanted to. And then the day came, man. You know, and summer of '84. I'm 22 years old. We're out in the garage. We're playing music. Me and my stepbrother and my other friend. And we stop. We take a break. And the drummer Greg goes, "Where's all the rocks?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And then so it was like crack, right? And I'd never tried that before. And what happened was, I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's my progression. It's how it went, right? So it's how it got, my progression got worse, right? And so that was the day it all changed. You know, I went instantly from controlling and enjoying to completely out of control. Couldn't, you know, it was just like, it was like a forest fire. You know, and and I was kind of like a little pissed, you know, like my stepbrother and my friend knew about it, and they turned me on to it anyways. They knew what it was like already. They'd already tried it, you know, and I was like, you know what I mean? But you know how kids are scandalous, right? It's like, oh, yeah, man, Rich has got a job. You know, he can help us, you know, get loaded and stuff. You know what I mean? Like, we could go over every payday, you know? You know, that kind of thing. You know, you got payday friends, right? So, you know, we all had those, right? We all had payday friends, you know? So that's kind of how it went, you know. So like 2 years of that hell, and it was literally hell. And I was pretty tore up in that time, you know. I was only so by the time I turned 24, or the summer of 86, I'm like probably not real far away from losing my job. And I loved that job, man. It was like, I was as comfortable at that job as you are in your living room watching TV. I mean, that's how comfortable I was at that place. I loved that job. Running printing presses was, it was cool, man. It was the kind of job that makes you feel like a man, you know what I mean? And you construction guys can relate, you know what I'm talking about. But it's just, so I did not want to lose that job. That was my security blanket. That was my hustle. That was everything. And one of my friends one time, he came back from rehab, man, and he looked good, man. He had color in his skin, man. He looked like he'd been eating, sleeping, you know. That's something I wasn't familiar with in a while. And his eyes were glowing, you know. I'm like, "Hey, Dan, how was rehab?" He goes, "It was good, bro." He goes, "You should go." You know, I'm like, and I knew he was right, man. So it was a short period of time after that conversation that I called the same place he went to. And that was July 17th, 1986, and it was the first day I got a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they gave it to us day one. They gave us the literature on day one. And then day two, the white van, right? They start taking you to meetings and stuff, you know. I asked them, you know, I had like two roommates. And I said, so, because I was wondering, like, what do they do to get you to stop? How do they get you to stop, right? Because I was like severely like addicted. I was obsessed. I had to be impatient. There was no way at that time I was going to be able to just go to meetings and like not drink in between meetings, okay? That was not going to happen back then, okay? So I was impatient for like 55 days. And then so they try to condense as much, you know, of program into you as they can during that time period. And I put 2 + 2 together real quick. I go, "Treatment leads to Alcoholics Anonymous." You know, and we were going to meetings, right? So I was talking to some of the old timers, and they're like, "Oh, so you got a $40,000 big book, huh?" I'm like, "Yeah." You know, the meaning that you're in treatment, right? You went to rehab. And they thought, "You could have just came here." Nah, bro, man, you don't understand. He goes, "Don't worry, just keep coming back." So, you know, so they basically, they're like, you know, because they know that once it's over, you know, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous in order to stay sober long term, you know. So they point you in this direction, and you know, it's you know, it's what they should do. But so that first sobriety lasted 6 months, right? I had the 55 days on the treatment, and then I went to 4 months of a sober living, and it was about 45 minutes from where I worked, and it was like, it was kind of a drive, and you know, the LA traffic and stuff, right? And it was in the city of Tustin, and then she moved the rehab, the sober living, to Newport Beach, and that was like, that became like over an hour drive, and that's when I had to leave, right? So that's when I got the phone call from Pops, you know, "Oh, you can come back and live here, you know." And you know how it is, right? You go to rehab. "Oh, he's good now, man. You know, he's, you know, they fixed him." Yeah. So that didn't work out too well. Within 2 weeks, I'd already drank, and I got with my stepbrother and my stepsister, and it just went bad. So then I moved out of there, and I moved in with one of my friends, and so that's when all the things that it talks about in chapter 3 started coming into play. You know, all the different methods we try to control and enjoy our drinking, and one of them was smoking weed only. That's the one I'd like to add to there anyway. But anyways, that failed miserably. It didn't work. So I guess it would be the equivalent of drinking beer only, right? For you hard drinkers out there that like to drink the hard stuff. So, because I remember I seen a full-blown alcoholic before, one of my mom's boyfriends when I was like a youngster, when I was like 10 years old, and he was already a full-blown alcoholic. He was drinking Old Granddad until he went blind. I used to have to light his cigarettes. And my mom was trying to get him to taper off drinking beer only, and it wasn't enough. It just, you know. And so I actually saw a full-blown alcoholic. I knew what one looked like. So it was like, I didn't know I was going to become one, but at least I knew what one looked like. I had a heads up anyways, right? So so that year got pretty bad. And then I finally, what happened one time was me and this guy that I was staying with for a minute, staying on his couch, I ended up owing this drug dealer some money, and he wanted it. And that was the week we had to pay the rent. So I chose to pay the rent instead of the other guy. And he was pissed. And he was there with one of his boys, and he pulled out a shotgun. And I thought he was going to blow me away, man. And so what he did, though, is he took the shotgun and he smashed it across my face. And I promised him I would give him his money next week, and he let it go at that. But that woke me up. Okay, that was like, that woke me up, all right? So I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I joined this one group called the South Bay Trudgers. They were like these book-thumping Nazis, man. I mean, like, we work the book exactly as it's written. We don't alter it in any way, shape, or form, word for word, you know what I mean? Like, it was like, oh, my God, these guys were serious, right? But you know what happened was I did get sober for like 7 months, but it just wasn't attractive, man. I wasn't having fun. It was like every meeting was like you hear a pin drop, and it was like if you weren't hanging your head in shame, it was like, you know, I don't know. I guess I wasn't ready yet. I went back and got loaded again, and I actually had a one-day relapse. I had 7 months. I had a one-day relapse, and then I came back for 2 more months, and then I relapsed for what I thought was going to be the last time. At the end of 1988, it was right after the Dodgers won the World Series, and it was about probably a week later, and I relapsed, and then that started like a 5-month run, and that was what I thought was going to be my last, you know, out there getting loaded. And I remember the day, you know, it was just the vicious cycle over and over and over again, man. Every payday, all money gone, you know, everything's gone by Friday. you know, top ramen and frozen burritos and water until next payday. And, you know, it's just that every single week, man, was the same thing, you know. And finally I had enough. And so what I did was one time when I was in the Book Nazi group, Saturday night was travel night, right? So they pick out a meeting and go to that meeting. And so they picked out this one meeting at the Imperial Lana Club in Paramount. And when they took us there, we all went together in a caravan. And we walked into the room. And the room was kind of small. It was like nowhere near as big as this room. But there was two guys sitting in the up against the back wall. And this one guy, they're counting $100 bills, right? He's got a stack of hundreds. This dude is like he had on this black leather jacket. It was a Raider jacket. It had a Raider emblem on it. It was a bitchin', man. It was one of those trench coats that go all the way down your ankles. The guy had a Mr. T starter kit, man. He had gold all around, man. I mean, the dude was like rolling, bro. He just hit a big bet. And the bookie, he was there with the bookie, and the bookie was paying him off, and they were counting the money. And I was like, oh, man, I wonder who this guy is. You know, so I go back there, and he's got a Boston Celtic hat on too, right? So he's a Raiders Celtic fan, right? This guy was the most charismatic dude I ever met in my entire life. He had this big mustache with a, you know, tall guy, 6'4", Polish guy. We used to call him Ski. Yeah, so I go back there, and I'm kind of eavesdropping on him a little bit. And I go, and he goes, man, you like football? And I go, yeah, man. And he goes, who's your team? And I go, the Chargers. And he goes, the Chargers. He goes, oh, God. He goes, I can't use them. I go, what do you mean? He goes, I can never predict when they're going to win or lose. He couldn't make any money on them. So we're just chopped. This guy's like really loud and boisterous, right? But the dude was cool, man. But what happened was, you know how they say attraction rather than promotion? I got the attraction right there. It's like, oh, you can have fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. These guys are betting on games. They're having fun, you know. They're doing all kinds of cool stuff. And it's like, oh, man, maybe this Alcoholics Anonymous thing will work after all. So what happened was a short period of time after that, I had that relapse, right? But when that relapse was done, that's where I went. I went to the Imperial Alano Club in Paramount, and I found this group. You know, they used to call it the Snake Pit. And that was my home group for almost 16 years. And so I finally got sober. So this time around, the first times I was trying to stay sober, it was like steps 1, 2, and 3 and out. 1, 2, 3, out. 1, 2, 3, out. That happened 3 times, right? And I was scared of the 4th and 5th step. I didn't want to do the inventory. You know, the sex part, you know, was messing with me. I didn't like that part. I didn't want to have to sit down with another guy and tell him, like, you know, all of my stuff, right? So I was balking, right? And so what happened was, is this time around, I got a little smarter. I thought, okay, you know what, man? I'm going to wait until I'm ready to work the steps until I ask somebody to be my sponsor. That took a year. So I stayed sober a year, and I got in a band right away. I met this long-haired dude, Jerry. He was a drummer, and he goes, hey, you play? Yeah, I play guitar, man. So I moved in with this guy, and we're jamming in the garage. And we're, you know, so I was staying busy, and I was going to a lot of meetings, you know. And it went pretty good. But then what was happening was, is I was attending meetings on a regular basis, and I was starting to hear people talk about, like, working the steps, right, you know, because you wanted to be, like, in the club, right? You had to be, like, one of the people that have worked the steps, you know, because if you weren't, you weren't going to make it, and you were a lightweight punk, you know. Like, no, seriously, I mean, like, this is a 12-step program, right? And, you know, and you have to work the steps. It's mandatory. They call it a suggestion, but it's mandatory, okay? If you want to recover, you will work the steps, or, you know, or you'll either be miserable or you'll go back out, okay? And misery won't last forever. You know, eventually that misery will seek an escape hatch, okay? And that's usually, you know, what we like to do, right? Either drink or whatever, okay? So that will only last for a certain, so I highly suggest that you work the steps, right? So when I was ready, I heard this guy in a meeting. He was talking about sex stuff, right? Hookers and all that stuff. And I like, oh, yeah, this guy's cool, man. I can relate to this guy. You know what I mean? So so what happened was after the meeting, we went to the coffee shop, right? And he introduced himself to me, you know, when we're talking. And he's telling me all his stuff, right? And I'm like, oh, man, you know what? This might be doable, you know what I mean? And so I asked him to be my sponsor. And so eventually, and he got me through that, he got me through the process, you know, he got me through the steps, you know, and he knew how to get me comfortable, you know, to where I could finally write that inventory, you know. What he did one night, man, was he goes, look, bro, he goes, I know you're having a hard time with the fourth step, man. He goes, look, he goes, it's just sex, bro. Everybody's trying to have it. Don't worry about it, all right? It's just like... He goes, I'll tell you what, man. He goes, I'll tell you all my deepest, darkest secrets. So he started laying it out, man. And I'm like, wow, this guy's pretty sick, man. I like this dude. You know what I mean? And so what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is the teacher will appear when the student's ready, right? So that person will be able to get you through what you're trying to get through. You know, they'll have their way of doing it, right? And they'll make you comfortable and you'll be able to do it. You'll be able to get through it. And so shortly after that, I wrote out my inventory. One night, I got on a mission, man. I went to another meeting, and I just got tired of being one of those people that hadn't worked all the steps yet. I had hit bottom with that, right? I'd hit bottom with balking. So I went to the store, and I got a notebook and a pen, and I wrote all night long. I must have wrote like 8 hours straight. I filled up this whole notebook, man. I just wrote everything. I started with I opened up a big book. I started with the resentments. I listed everything I could think of, and then I got onto all the other stuff, the fear, you know. And then I got to the sex inventory and all that stuff. And I just wrote. And he goes, look, bro. He goes, I just need the exact nature of the wrongs. I don't need all the hookers' names and addresses.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah. okay, all right. So that kind of cleared it up. There's a lot of them, man. I mean, that would have been a lot of research. Yeah. But I was kind of relieved, you know, at that part, right? And then another thing he told me, too, he goes, don't worry about the moral part. He goes, you don't have any morals. He goes, we're going to give you some later. He goes, look. Just write the inventory. You know, we'll sell you some morals later on. Okay. So I finally got that written. And then we did the fifth step shortly after that. And, you know, it ended up one of those situations where I was making a mountain out of a molehill. It really didn't go that bad. It was fine, man. You know, and like I said, my sponsor, he was a pretty sick dude. So after he heard my stuff, he was like, hey, look, bro, he goes, can I borrow that inventory? I go, what do you mean, man? He goes, I'm having trouble sleeping at night. He goes, that ought to do it. I was like, oh, my God. But anyways, yeah, here you go, bro. So Dave was my sponsor for quite a while, and I ended up getting 16 years, you know. My years in LA were pretty cool. Like I said, I was working as a printing press operator all that whole time period from 81 to 2009. And then the first 10 years of my sobriety went pretty good. And I was, you know, doing everything that we do, right? You know, being of service, going to meetings and all this stuff. And then I kind of started slacking off, right? Things started getting good at work. I got promoted. I was making more money. You know, I was getting to that kind of point where, like, better than, you know, the, you know, like, you know, your shit don't stink, kind of like that. And I even had a couple of people call me out on it, man. So I was, like, getting close to, like, my program was slipping, like, the last 5 years. And I moved in with this one person, and I was isolating, and I wasn't going to as many meetings. But everything was going good at work, but I wasn't really doing anything for my program. And so finally the day came, man, when one of my coworkers, he goes, hey, Rich, man, I got a new job. You want to help me celebrate? And I'm like, what do you mean? So he reached into his pocket, pulled out this little sacky poo, right? He goes, take this into the bathroom. I looked at it for a second, man. And this is like 5 years of like massive complacency. No spiritual defense against the first drink, right? And that was gone. That was out the window. And I had a Monster in my hand. I'm drinking Monsters. I'm drinking like four of these a day. I mean, what's a little speed, right? So so I took it into the bathroom, and I did it, and I, you know, and that was it, man. I was gone. My plan was to come back the next day like nothing had ever happened, and it didn't go that way. You know, it was daily from that point on. You know, and so what happened was, is I'm kind of out there, right? And I'm kind of like in no man's land, you know, sort of like in, I have no connections. I don't know anybody, right? You know, and so then I'm kind of like, because I used to work a 12-hour schedule where I'd work like 3 days and I had 4 days off. So during those 4 days off, I'd be thinking like, what am I going to do, man? I don't know anybody, and except for some of the people at work. And then other than that, and then I started brainstorming. I'm thinking, the hookers get loaded. So I go to the neighborhood where I, you know, regularly picked up prostitutes, and I pull up to this one girl, and she's like, "What's up, baby? You want a date?" And I'm like, "No, man, you know where to get any dope." So she goes, "Yeah." So I let her in, you know, and we go do that and everything, and it just kind of, it got, you know, I was out there. So my disease started to progress pretty quick. This was after almost 16 years sober, right? I made it to 15 years and 8 months, and I relapsed, you know, and it was massive complacency that led to it, you know, and like built up resentments, you know, stuff that we don't deal with. If you let those resentments build up, they'll be like a pressure cooker, you know, and that's why we got to do the daily inventory and all that stuff, because it has to be addressed, right? So if you don't address that stuff, it builds up like a pressure pot, you know, and the book says the resentments are number one offender, and they will take you out. So that happened along with the complacency thing, and so I'm on this 5-year run, right? And I'm hanging out like in this gang neighborhood and in LA, and I have to admit it, man, it was a lot of fun for a while. These guys were like, you know, they were hooking me up, you know, I'd show up, and it took me a minute, right? And they were like, man, who's this white boy, man? Is he a cop? No, it's Rich, man. He's cool, don't worry. Yeah. You know, he's got money, he likes to get rooms, you know, he parties, you know. Oh, all right, you know. It took me about a year before that kind of went away a little bit, because they were looking at me sideways for a while, right? But after a while, it started to get good, actually, and I'd go over like different people's houses, and they'd be hooking me up with girls, and you know, all kinds of stuff, man. I had it going on, actually, like, to be honest with you, for a minute, and then until the money ran out, right? And then that's that. when I relapsed, I had 30 grand in the bank. I had 250,000 in a 401k, and I had a lump sum pension that I could cash out too, and So I was hustling. I was doing good on that for a while, and eventually. So what happened at work was they needed to lay off one person because they had too many operators. And I stayed sober, I wouldn't have been that guy. I wasn't going to volunteer for that. But when this came up, I was like, you know, they knew I was drinking and using again, and they kind of gave me the look, like, you know. Yeah, okay, I'll volunteer. So the plan was to leave there and get my severance pay for like 9 months, but get a job at this other place where that one guy that got me loaded the first time went. I was going to get a job where he was running a press at. And so that was the plan, right? But what happened was, is I became unemployable. I got pretty tore up. And when I went over there to take a tour of the place, I kind of realized, man, it's like, man, I'm kind of like, I ain't right. You know what I mean? I'm like, I don't think I'm going to be able to make it through this interview. And they're going to know, you know, that, you know, this guy's like this drug addict. You know what I mean? So it was kind of getting obvious that it was getting bad, right? So what happened was, after my 9 months ran out, they called me back to my old job, and they gave me my job back. And that lasted a year and a half. And during that year and a half, it was like really, really bad. And that was my last year and a half in L.A. So I lost my job February 19th of 2009. That my mom's birthday. They fired me on my mom's birthday. And so I called her and told her that I lost my job. And, you know, I was staying in a motel. The last year I lived in LA, I was in this crack motel, you know, like $275 a week. And because my mom was sending me my mail and stuff. And so about a month later, I get a phone call from her, and she goes, "Hey, Rich," she goes, "why don't you come down here to San Diego?" I said, "Man, that sounds like a good idea." Because I was like pretty close to homeless, right, at that time. And for me, that's a major red flag. I'm not one of those guys that's going to go out there and pitch a tent and keep using, all right? That's not going to be me. I ain't going out like that. So when my mom called and invited me to come down here, I go, "Oh, yeah, that'd be cool to go back to San Diego." You know what I mean? And it's like, "I'll be right there." You know? So I threw my stuff in the car and I came down here, and that was in April of 09. It took me 11 months to get sober. What happened was, is I went from daily to periodic. She got me a job right away as a temp assignment that I was working at the company where she worked at. And my drinking and using went to like periodic. So it was only happening like about every 2 or 3 weeks, but I was staying sober like 3 weeks in between. And so after a while, I started to realize like, man, I might be able to just get sober again. You know what I mean? And so I finally did, you know, and then the day came when I kind of hit a bottom. I just like, it hurt, man. It hurt. Like I just had that moment of clarity. Like I thought, man, my mom brought me down here to help me, and I'm still, you know, trying to, you know, get loaded. And I couldn't do it no more. I couldn't hurt it no more. And so I went to the other fellowship. I looked up the directory, and I found a meeting in Imperial Beach, and I started going to Narcotics Anonymous, and that's where I got clean at for this sobriety that I'm in right now. For a while, I was going to NA, and it was going pretty good. It was going pretty good. I got my first 6 years in NA, and before I took my seventh birthday, it was around the holidays, and somebody told me about this place, and they said, "Hey, man, they got these Alcathons over there. You know, if you need a place to go during the holiday, man, it's a great place." You know, so I go, "All right," you know. So I started coming over here, and that was like probably a little over 8 years, about 9 years ago. And, you know, they had the place all decorated with the Christmas tree and everything. And I was like, it was cool, man. And I was kind of getting a little disenchanted with the other fellowship. Some things were going on I didn't really care for that much. And so I started coming over here, and I kind of switched. I switched to AA, right? And I never really cared for the basic text of NA anyways. I always liked the AA literature better, because the Big Book was my first piece of recovery literature, and that's where I worked my steps out of and everything. So, and what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous too is the foundation is here, man. You cannot beat the foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, all the old timers are here. It's like, you know, I mean, it's like this AA is strong. I mean, it's like, so, and it's, you know, and they don't seem to struggle with their money or their seventh tradition, and they get people jacking the, you know, the treasurer running off with the money, you know. You know what I'm saying? You know, these guys were running off like with $150. I'm like, man, what kind of chicken shit is that? You can't even handle $150, bro. You got to steal the money, really? You know? And it's like they were pressing charges against this one guy, and I'm like, oh, God, man, really? It's like, you know, so I was like, nah, you know, I had a job, I worked, you know, I didn't need to mess around with all that stuff. So I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been here ever since, you know. And so I actually just recently took 15 years again for the second time. So it's, you know, for me, it's 15 years times two, right? Now, I have what they call cumulative sobriety, right? It's my story, okay? It's the lesser respected of the two. You know, the continuous sobriety obviously is the more respected one, but you know, but the one thing that I am happy about is that since I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous 39 years ago, I have actually been cumulatively sober for 32 of those years. So that's not that bad. I'll take it. You know, I've heard a lot worse. You know, a lot worse. I had a friend in L.A. It took him 18 years to get one. You know, so, you know, I'll take my story. You know what I mean? And And, you know, really, honestly, to be honest with you, man, I never thought I would relapse. You know, when I remember when I lived in L.A. and I was sober all those years, and I thought my sobriety was bulletproof, man. And I had to find out the hard way that it ain't, you know. And there's a little phrase in the book where it talks about, you know, if you let your spiritual condition drop, the insanity of drink will return, right? And that's what happened, you know. So, that's one of the lessons I learned, you know. Meeting makers make it, you know. It's just, you know, the thing is it talks about the 24-hour period and the maintenance of your spiritual condition. And it's critical. It really is. It's critical. You want to be plugged into Alcoholics Anonymous. You do not want to be, you know, going to meetings once in a while, you know, a little here, a little there. No, you don't want to be one of those people. You're when you're in that condition, you're like on the fringe. You're not in the wagon, you're on it. And if you're on it, you can fall off. You got to get in the wagon, you know what I mean? So in the herd, they say, right? So, you know, and I look at, you know, the examples around here of all the old timers that come here, man, and there's people here 50 years. I mean, there's a bunch of people here with like almost 50 years. You know, we got like two or three women that have almost 50 years. We got like two or three guys that got over 50 years. Like, that's like pretty good, man. And there's a whole bunch of 30s and 40s and 20s. And, you know, it's just like a lot of long-term sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, man. And it's the example that I follow, you know. So this time around, you know, I remember a while back, you know. So since I've been sober this time around, I've actually worked like three full sets of steps. The first two I did with my sponsor from L.A. because I needed to inventory my relapse. I needed to inventory all the stuff that was like current, you know. So I did all that stuff with him. And unfortunately, my sponsor passed away. My first sponsor in L.A. passed away. He got hurt in a ladder accident like about, oh, God, I want to say like 10 years ago. He fell off a ladder, and he crushed the bottom of his foot. And he went to the hospital, and he had surgery, and he got infected, and they couldn't get rid of the infection. So they had to amputate his leg below the knee. And that just, like, it just destroyed him. You know, he was an active guy. He was going to the gym and stuff like that, and it just destroyed him. You know, so eventually he ended up having a heart attack and he died. And that was my friend, Redheaded Dave. When I got down here, you know, I had a sponsor in NA for a minute, but then I asked George, you know, the thing I noticed about at the time, like when I noticed about George was a step working fool, man. I was like, man, this guy works steps, bro. I was like, I was impressed, you know what I mean? And he came in like about 6 months after me, right? Five or 6 months after me, and we've both been here on this run now ever since, you know, right? So I was able to get work a set of steps with George also too, and you know, it's kind of funny when I was doing my fifth step, Maria snuck in there. She's kind of like hanging out, like, I want to hear some dirt. But it was cool. It was cool. It was very cool. And I wish I could. I really. I don't know, man. It sounds like an excuse. I really wish I could do more, but my work schedule is like a second shift work schedule, and I work from 3 to midnight. So the group that you're in, you guys work steps all the time, right? But you guys get together during the hours that I'm at work, you know. So that's one of the things. That's why the Nooner is my home group, right? Because I hit the Nooner every single day. And then on the weekend, I go to, you know, I'm able to go to other meetings, you know. But I've actually sponsored a couple of guys here. I'm very, very happy to say that they're still sober, you know, and doing well, you know. We did some step work, you know, I've done some service here. I had a noon commitment for a couple of years before I finally turned it over, and That was really, really, really good. I would suggest, you know, when it comes to like, you know, one of the things that's really cool about Alcoholics Anonymous, you can be of service any number of different ways. Just find your niche. Find what works for you. Find what's comfortable for you. You know, you'll find stuff that you want to do. You know what I mean? And uh, And just do it your way, man, because, you know, if we all do it our own way, then it all collectively, it all adds up to like a whole bunch of service, you know, and it's a really good thing. The Women's Auxiliary here, they're an example, you know, an awesome example, actually. I love what they do here. And, you know, it's just everything's like, you know, just trying to help another alcoholic, you know. You know, I love being sober. I love my sobriety. It's my security blanket, you know. I finally, you know, after a while, it took me a minute, but I finally got another career, you know, which surpassed the career I had in L.A., you know. So I'm doing really well there. I actually got retrained as a machinist, and it's going good, man. I have a really good relationship with my boss. They love me, man. I bust my butt, man. They're just like, God, Rich, you're an animal, bro. You know, and what's really cool is working around like some of these, like I work in aerospace and I work with a lot of like engineers and people that have college educations and stuff. So I'm used to like not using profanity. You know what I mean? I'm kind of like, you don't want to use profanity in those environments. It makes you sound stupid. Okay. And they will look at you like you're ignorant. You know what I mean? And the guys that do it, I just kind of like shake my head like, bro, you're not helping yourself. You know, it's just, and so I've kind of learned to play the role, right? You know, you want to try to sound intelligent. You know, you're working on parts that go in Raptors and F-35s and F-16s, and you want to try to sound like you know what you're doing. You know what I mean? And things come up too, you know, because there's some machinists in the room. They know what I'm talking about. You know, you got to be in spec, right? Anybody can measure your work with a caliper or a micrometer, and they can come by and say, oh, nope, it's out of spec. And then you got to explain why, right? So honesty is the best policy, right? You know, so you just got to be forthright and tell them, look, man, I messed up. I went too far. You know, and if you're sincere, man, they'll you know, and they like you, you know, they'll be okay. You know, if you're honest, it's okay, you know. Maybe the part gets rejected, maybe it doesn't, maybe they can fix it, maybe they can't. I haven't had too many rejected, maybe one or two in like 5 years of doing this particular job that I'm at right now, but all the other parts have been able to be like repaired or fixed. So just by being honest, you know, it works, you know, and applying the principles that I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so Mike was the only one that introduced himself as a newcomer. But he's a retread. Yeah. I have a special place in my heart for retreads. I've been there. I know what that's like. Keep coming back, man. Don't give up. Don't give up, man. The thing is, man, is once I conceded to myself that I was an alcoholic, there was really no turning back at that point. I knew what I was, and I know what I am. And to go back out there and drink again is insane. It's just insane, you know, because I fit the description in the book, right? Everything that's in the doctor's opinion, everything that's in chapter 3, I fit all that stuff to a T, right? That's me. So it's like once we all start off cucumbers, right? But once you become a pickle, there ain't no going back to a cucumber. You're an alcoholic for life, right? So it's your choice whether or not you want to be a sober alcoholic or whether you want to die inactive drinking. And for me, you know, I want to be sober more than I want to be drunk. You know what I mean? And that's my motivating. Your past will become your greatest asset because it'll be your motivator. It'll keep you moving forward. Everybody in this room knows what they're going to return to if they go back to drinking. And I know a lot of people in this room, and I know it ain't good. So I know it ain't good. I've heard the stories. So, I want to thank Pioneers for asking me to speak tonight. And even though it was the night of the convention, I'm pretty impressed. There's a lot of people here. And thank you for the support, man. You know, I love all you guys. You know, I come here all the time, and I know most of you, you know. And so it's really been an honor to speak. And I was nervous at first, but it took a second. And I go, oh, I know all these people, man. It should be cool. I can tell my story, you know what I mean? They'll be all right. So This is my first time, right, speaking here at Pioneer, so it is a little intimidating. To be honest with you, it is a little bit intimidating, but you know what? Thank you for being here, and welcome to the newcomers. Please keep coming back, and God bless you all. Thank you.